We're going to call the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight to order. We do not yet have a quorum, but we're going to ask Representative Paymar to start because he is present. Representative Paymar, we can't quite move your bill yet because we don't have a quorum, but if you want to start describing it, as soon as we have a quorum, we'll move it. Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this is House File 366, and basically this is it's just a housekeeping bill for the Post Board. It updates and clarifies Post Board duties and procedures regarding pre-service and continuing education requirements for peace officers. There's no substantive changes in either the Post Board's powers or duties. In Section 1 of the bill, it strikes obsolete language regarding Post Board certification of various peace officer education programs and replaces it with the certification of post-secondary schools that then actually provide the peace officer education training today. Section 2 makes some technical amendments to the board authority referencing post-secondary schools that are certified to provide professional peace officer education programs. And finally, in Section 3 of the bill, it strikes obsolete language regarding certification of the various peace officer education programs that previously existed and replaces it with the certification of post-secondary schools. I have with me today Jennifer Berquam, who is the Legislative and Rules Coordinator with the Post Board. So if you have any specific questions about the rationale behind these changes, she can answer those questions. As I said, it's basically a housekeeping bill for the Post Board.
We do have a quorum, so I will officially call the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight to order. And Representative Paymar moves that House File 366 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Public Safety Policy Omnibus Bill. Questions from members? Did you have something specific you wanted to state?
Madam Chair, thank you. I don't believe the Representative Paymar did a good job of explaining our department.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Jennifer Berquam. I'm the Legislative and Rules Coordinator with the Minnesota Board of Peace Officer Standards and Training.
All right. Seeing no questions from members, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right. Seeing none. Representative Paymar renews his motion that House File 366 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Public Safety Policy Omnibus Bill. Thank you, Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Mullery, are you ready? Representative Mullery, are you starting with House File 448?
Okay, Madam Chair. Just a second, I have to clean up after Representative Paymar. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 448. And this one
It needs to be re-referred to the Health Care and Human Services and Oversight Division.
Oh,
we'll actually be voting on this one, Representative Mullery.
Okay. Madam Chair, I have with me today Sue Hansen, who will describe in detail the need for the bill, but I think we all are aware of the need for quick responses when somebody is having emergency because of their mental illness, and we need to have them referred to a mental health crisis team. But Sue can explain it better.
Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
My name is Sue Hansen. I'm chair of the Legislative Committee, and I'm on the board of directors for NAMI Minnesota. But more importantly, I'm the parent of a 34-year-old man with schizophrenia who has been ill for the last 14 years. So we have used a lot of these crisis services over the last 14 years. I'm here to represent NAMI Minnesota and give you their feelings on this. NAMI Minnesota was thrilled that the legislature decided to invest in the development of mental health crisis teams in Minnesota. A variety of crisis services provide an essential safety net for all people with mental illness and their families. Mobile crisis teams can go to a person's home, assess the situation, and provide services to help stabilize the individual who is in crisis. There are urgent and crisis services at mental health centers and clinics. Crisis homes provide a safe place where people can live for a few days while they receive supportive therapy, stabilization, monitoring, and transition to other services. These are very cost-effective ways of dealing with a mental health crisis and can prevent people from going into the emergency rooms at hospitals or even prevent a police response. Now that they are developing, we need to use them. Right now, there is no one number to call when you or a loved one is having a mental health crisis. In the metro area alone, there are 8 numbers. It makes it very confusing for everybody. Earlier this summer, NAMI surveyed its members and asked the question, if you or your child or relative has had a mental health crisis or emergency, who responded or where did you or your child or relative go? If more than once, please let us know what happened most recently. The responses were quite interesting. People first reached out to their psychiatrist, 31.4%. Then there were the emergency rooms, actually, which was a little higher, 32.4%. Police was 22.5%. EMTs, only 1%. Mental health crisis teams, only 12.7%. And crisis homes, nobody called. We know that not enough people are aware of crisis teams. Through this grant, persons with mental illness will receive better care and better follow-up with resources and less recidivism. In Grand Rapids alone, your crisis response team, law enforcement, ambulance, ER, and mental health professionals all collaborate, and their 911 operators dispatch the crisis team and the police for all behavioral health emergency calls. NAMI believes that we can make this work, at least in parts of the state. We really urge you to support this bill.
Questions from members? Seeing none, I believe. Representative
Jarkowski. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mullery, is there a cost to this bill?
Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, I don't think that this bill, the next one I have, there is, but I don't believe that this one has any cost.
Representative Jarkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, will the need for some of the services grow due to these calls being funneled to these agencies?
Representative Mullery?
Madam Chair, I think Ms. Hansen could probably answer this.
Ms. Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. In our experience, it would be the opposite, that there would be less services because the response team would come out to the home and actually take care of it, so the police personnel wouldn't have to take care of it. It would be less expensive. And the person would not necessarily go to an emergency room.
Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Or to Representative Mullery or to the witness, in Section 2 it talks about enhancement activities may include mental health crisis training. Is that going to be addressed in the subsequent bill that you have, House File 449, or is that something separate? And can our current 911 jurisdictionally, can they, our dispatchers, do this on their own, provide the training? I would imagine there would be some cost to the counties to bring dispatchers up to speed on this kind of referral.
Representative Mullery, or
I don't want to stop your bill from going forward, but I'm not sure if it needs a fiscal note, but I'm just curious about if you think that counties can absorb the cost.
Madam Chair, Representative Kramer, it specifically says may, so if the county wanted to do it, they can. If they don't want to do it because there's cost or something, they don't have to.
Representative
Kramer. I'm trying to get it. Would there be a cost if they wanted to do this? Do you know the answer to that?
Ms. Hansen?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I don't have that available. I can certainly give the information to you, but not yet for this session.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. Representative Tamar, we will look into that, and because I am certain that if there's a fiscal cost, probably it's something your committee will want to request. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you, Representative Tamar. Further questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
My name is Michael Unglin. I'm a citizen who suffers from mental illness. I want to thank Representative Mueller for advancing this bill. We're not often on the same side. I think we've had a couple of meetings that I've been in where it didn't go so well, but this is an important bill, as is the companion bill. I think that'll be spoken of about next. I'll probably talk about that one when it comes up. So right now there seems to be a question about some of the fiscal impact that various municipalities may have. And in terms of a, you know, like a fiscal note or something too, I think it'd be good to note the hidden cost of not doing something. I had an experience with a law enforcement officer. I'm not going to go into tons of detail on it, but I was in a crisis situation, and he did not choose to invoke any of the training that he had had relative to CIT training and bring in a mental health crisis team, which may have handled things differently than dragging me, and that's a literal term, into his car and off to jail. The mental illness in jail does not mix very well for a variety of reasons. I wanted jail personnel to document some of what the police officer had done to me just by taking pictures. They refused. Things got worse. By not having done the simple thing up front, and that includes the 911 operator who made no inquiry relative to the fairly reasonable likelihood of mental illness being a part of this. The call came from a hospital. I was in the hospital. The cost to the human cost to me, my family, and whatever concentric circles you want to put around that, it's huge. Because of the full tragedy of the day, I am currently in federal court against Hennepin County, Minneapolis, police officers, many jail personnel, many jail administrative personnel, because of a combination of the behaviors that they did that violated every policy associated with the treatment of mentally ill persons as well as others. I will be taking the experience that I have doing this pro se, and I'm probably going to lose because I don't know what I'm doing. I had an estimate of $50,000 to $70,000 to have an attorney fight this. And because of the risks, nobody wants to take it on contingency. So I'm doing it. Well, and the reason I'm bringing this up,
if you could just
keep
your comments
right
to the bill.
Here's the cost. The cost to the county is two attorneys plus staff since June 9th, 2008. Cost to the city is one attorney plus staff, multiple iterations of pleadings, counter pleadings, whatever they're all called. There's a lot of money, and what I will be doing is taking what I've learned, and I will be spreading that out to any and everybody who suffers from mental illness or other kinds of police abuse, so that they fight it.
All right.
So I just wanted people to know if there's already a cost, if there have been other costs, and I will try to drive that cost up so that it becomes painful so that police and jail personnel don't do what they do. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Questions from members? All right, seeing none, with that, Representative Mullery renews his motion that House File 448 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Health Care and Human Services Policy and Oversight Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Hearing none, motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
I would move House File Number 449.
Yes, Representative Mallory.
And I believe that has to go to Finance.
This also needs to go to the Health Care and Human Services Policy and Oversight Committee next as well.
Okay.
It will have to go to Finance as well.
Okay.
First policy. Representative Mallory, go ahead.
Madam Chair, the first thing I would do is an oral amendment, which is just deleting line 1.12. They don't want to be in it.
All right. Questions from members? All right. Representative Mallory moves that line 1.12.
Yep.
Don't you need to delete from the period? Oh, I'm on the wrong one. Sorry. I guess that's enough.
We're just deleting the Barbara Schneider Foundation.
Great. Representative Mallory moves that line 1.12 be deleted. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the same as last year, except for one thing. It passed unanimously last year and went to Finance and there wasn't enough money. This is to train people with basically CIT training, which is the best. It's a 40-hour program, which has been a very effective. Many officers have been trained in Minneapolis, many around the state, and we really need these crisis teams within the police departments so that they can work with mental illness. It's good both for police, society, and for the people with the mental illness not to be in altercations, because many people with mental illness react the opposite way that regular people that don't have that to different actions by police. And if police take what they consider their normal training, it can exacerbate the situation if somebody's person they're working with has certain mental illnesses, and this trains them how to work with it, and it's diffused a great number of situations. I believe Ms. Hansen has something to say, and then the one of the chief training officers, Steve Wickelgren, is also here.
Okay, Ms. Hansen, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I mentioned, I'm a member of NAMI Minnesota. We have a 34-year-old son with schizophrenia. So we have used the crisis services many times, or I should say the 911 service many times. We've had police to our home at least at 8 times, and it involved 3 different suburban police departments and 2 different areas of the Minneapolis Police Department. So we've had many mental health crises with our son. And believe me, the response is always different each and every time, depending on who you call. I am here today to testify in support of House File 449, which would fund CIT training in Minnesota. NAMI and the Mental Health Legislative Network both strongly support this bill. For too many of us, we or our loved ones have come into contact with police during a mental health crisis. Too often, these have not been good experiences. In November, I had the opportunity to hear Major Sam Cochran speak at the NAMI State Conference. Really, people consider him the father of CIT. He's from Memphis, which is where the program began. What he said in his speech was that CIT is a model program designed to improve the outcomes of police interactions with people with mental illnesses. It is a community collaboration, not just a training program. CIT officers are trained to prevent crises and to de-escalate a crisis when it occurs. But CIT is not just training. It is only effective when law enforcement, the mental health system, and consumer and family advocates collaborate to make sure that when officers divert someone, the treatment system is willing and able to provide appropriate treatment. CIT works for law enforcement. It provides officers tools for responding more safely and compassionately to people with serious mental illness. It gives officers options rather than arrest and incarceration when they encounter people with mental illness. It improves public safety and reduces officers' injuries while reducing the amount of time that they spend dealing with mental disturbance calls. CIT officers report that they are more satisfied with CIT than with other jail diversion approaches. It works for consumers as well. It improves consumer safety through the use of de-escalation techniques. Officers can help prevent a crisis from deteriorating to the point where the use of force is likely. When they encounter a CIT officer, consumers are more likely to be transferred to treatment, to stay out of jails and emergency rooms, and receive treatment in the community. It frees up public resources by diverting people with serious mental illness from jails. It helps ensure that jails are used to incarcerate criminals and not people who require treatment. CIT also saves public resources by preventing people from deteriorating to the point where they end up in jail. Finally, CIT saves police time and money by creating an efficient system for transferring people from law enforcement custody to mental health treatment. We do have many police and sheriffs that are trained in Minnesota, but it's extremely important to continue these efforts, and we ask that you do that. Thank you so very much for listening.
Mr. Wickelgren?
Correct.
Okay, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Steve Wickelgren. I am Sergeant with Minneapolis PD and President of the Minnesota CIT Officers Association. I'm here to support this also. I can talk about the training in detail, but the main point of that is that for the last 4 or 5 years I've been involved in this. In my 21 plus years of law enforcement, I have seen the change not only in myself but in many officers who receive many, many hours of training in use of force and general public safety procedures. We all know the variety of tasks that officers are expected to deal with. Many of those practices and trainings are standardized to controlling chaos, to bringing order to many different situations. Like Sue said, this does not work with people in a mental health crisis. The 40-hour class brings about a mindset that is very different with the tools we give them, the basic tools of de-escalation, understanding internally what's going on with the mentally ill, and bringing about better results. Throughout Memphis and in Minneapolis and many agencies, there's documented cases and documented research regarding the numbers of lives and injuries and lessened use of force reports when this training has been incorporated. So we know that not only is it saving money, but we're saving people, including officers, which I'm partial to, along with the mentally ill. I myself have transitioned from officer, which I still am, into a mental health professional. I provide services for Minneapolis officers and their families now. So that importance is very dear to my heart, is treating the mentally ill the way they deserve to be treated. We know there is not parity regarding mental health issues. In law enforcement, there's a lot of disparity, and this training really brings up the expectations for officers and how they deal with them. On our website, www.mncit.org, there's a story listed from one of our trainings in Olmsted County where we tell officers that when you get back to the streets, you'll probably notice more readily the people you're dealing with and the mental state they're in, and that you might notice it very soon. One of the deputies on his way home Friday afternoon after the training was very close to an emotionally disturbed person call, and he got out, dealt with a veteran, a military veteran, who was off his medications, had been diagnosed with bipolar, and described the encounter with him and how using some of the techniques he had just learned was able to calm things down, get him into the squad car, and get him to a proper facility. And I talked to him personally, and how he said prior to that training, he has no idea how that would have went. He can only imagine, and he knows it would not have been as calm and without any force. So that perspective, that mindset change, was very important for him. I also know that the police culture changes slowly. The training, my years of training, I have really stuck with me. Changing that mindset is difficult. With this extra training, with the extra money, we can provide more training for officers and speed up that expectation of how officers deal with people in these crises.
I'm going to interrupt you here. We actually have some questions from members. So, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The concern was, are we doing it already? It sounds like we are with the Minneapolis. Where are we not doing it? In, is the Twin Cities area pretty much the departments, the police departments doing it, and it's the outstate that doesn't have this capability, or what would you say is our biggest hole of meeting the needs?
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Whittlegren?
Thank you. Minneapolis police have fully incorporated the CIT program. Across the river in St. Paul, Ramsey County, they are just starting to develop programs. Some of the metro agencies, there are a small handful of agencies that are getting officers trained and starting programs. Outstate, the Department of Human Services has provided grants. Our association has been up in the area of Thief River Falls. Now, this spring, Southwest Minnesota, Worthington, Marshall, Wilmer are being provided with the training, and again, it's the startup program. Rochester has been into it for a couple of years. They've got a fairly established program. Outstate is starting to get into it, but the metro area also is, with the number of officers there, it's really lacking in where it should be to get that proper response.
Follow up, Representative Anderson. All right, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is important training. I'm just curious, the amount of money being spent doesn't seem as much perhaps as needed for the amount of problems that are out there. How many officers do you think can be trained with this amount of money that's being considered?
Mr. Whittlegren.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It could be figured out. In the metro area, the core of our trainers are from the metro area, mostly through Minneapolis. We've got the extended program. The week-long training is actually fairly inexpensive in the metro area. It's $500 an officer, which standard, if you're not aware, is $500 to $800 for a week-long training. When we go outside the metro area, the cost goes up, you know, fairly substantial, because part of the training is we use professional actors for the core of the training is scenario-based, where the actors are playing the role of mentally ill. So we have officers coaching the scenarios, the actors in the scenarios, not only paying for them, but hotel costs. So an outstate class is close to around $20,000 for the week. So it does get expensive. So the number of officers depends on where it's at.
All right. Further questions from members? All right, seeing none, is there anyone out in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? You can come forward, but please remember that you testified previously on the other bill, and so anything new. Okay.
Mike Unwin again. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members, and others who are involved in advancing this bill. I'm going to speak out of two sides of my mouth, or both sides of my mouth, and I hope I can clarify that a little bit. But The first side is absolutely, this bill is so critical, I can hardly, you know, I can hardly fathom it. I wasn't able to make a decision to come down here until about 12:25. And part of it is because of the kinds of actions that happen here. The devastation that runs through the family, particularly if you decide that you want to right wrongs or make a point of not letting this happen to others, is that it's very, very hard on family, and family want people like myself to let go. Just let it go. And it's not in me to let it go. Not only for myself, you know, I'm not that good that I can just say this isn't in part for myself, but I don't want it to happen to other people, what happened to me that day. And that could be, at least percentage-wise, dramatically altered by exactly what you heard from the people who already testified. If there's one thing that I can say that would maybe be the most impactful relative to what you heard, it would be the single word ditto. They're right. They're right with what they're saying. They're not blowing smoke. They're right. One area of concern that I do have, and I understand that in this fiscal time, it's probably not best to make this mandatory for all officers and deputies and sheriffs, etc. So let it be whatever it can be afforded. I mean, that's okay. I get that. It'll get better over time. That's okay. One thing, one word in the bill says sheriff, and per revisor statute, sheriff refers to not only the sheriff, but others that report to the sheriff, like deputies and things like that. And I don't know if this bill means that, or if it just means like local sheriffs where there aren't police officers. But I hope that it includes detention personnel under the word sheriff, because the word sheriff does refer to that in other places, that it's, that the word sheriff means all those other things.
Thank you.
Final point, and I'll try to make it really quick, and that is, there are already tons of procedures and policies and rules and regulations that in theory would drive the behavior of law enforcement and detention personnel to not do things that people worry about relative to not only those who are mentally ill, but any other citizen. They don't follow them because, too often, they don't follow them. Some do, okay? But too often, they don't get followed because there's not much penalty for not following them, and the same is at risk relative to the training. The training will diffuse through the mindset. I understand what they're saying about it takes time. But the lack of accountability relative to training policies and procedures is unimaginable. And anything that can be added to this bill or the law that forces accountability will have 10 times the impact of a procedure or a training requirement. Thank you.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question, maybe an observation, Mr. Wickergren. One of the criteria you have is the training must be at least 40 hours. I was just wondering if you had any thought to, if the program can accomplish your first five criteria, to reduce that mandate so that more departments could take advantage of the program.
Mr. Wickergren.
Thank you. Yes, the 40 hours comes about from the Memphis model, which has become an international model. We as an association have a certification course. A lot of the training officers attend, you sit in your chair, you get a certificate at the end. This is a pass-fail course. We equate it to SWAT officers. Not every officer is built to be a SWAT officer. Not every officer is necessarily built to be a CIT officer. So officers going through that will need to pass the course. And the standard across the nation and now internationally is a 40-hour certification course. We do offer, for agencies that can't afford as much, a 4-hour, 8-hour We're going out to Buffalo. They wanted us to put together a 3-day course. We will gladly do that to increase awareness, but we follow the Memphis model of that 40-hour certification course, and nationally that is what is known as CIT. The other trainings are considered mental health awareness de-escalation training.
Thank you. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, but those would not qualify then to apply for the grant program.
Mr. Wicklegreen.
That, yes, that is my understanding.
Representative Cass.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question I have here is that, you know, after hearing your testimony about the fact that a lot of our metro areas are already putting this into practice, that we're seeing a lot of grants or dollars being spent on this type of training, is there anything in place here where this is going to be focused on areas that currently do not have any training or any programs? Because I would hate to see these dollars being spent, you know, in an area that is already putting money there. I'd rather have it not supplant somebody else's funding that's already in place here. I want this to be focused on place where those dollars are really needed.
Representative Mullery.
Well, Madam Chair, this language was worked out by Sue Abderholden, who is the head of NAMI in Minnesota. I believe that that leaves it up to the Commissioner of Public Safety to decide where it's needed the most, and I assume that they'll do a good job on that, and they have the advice of these other groups that are listed there as to where the grants are needed.
Representative
Kass. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess that, you know, I guess some trust does have to be placed in there, but I believe that some sort of a wording or language in there to say that, you know, if this is a starting point for some of these areas, and these are critical dollars to offer grants for that, it'd be nice to see if there was a mechanism here to make sure that we're not supplanting current funding.
Thank you. Representative Cornish.
Well, Madam Chair, to the testifier, I guess I think the $144,000 is a drop in the bucket. This is what you would really need. 40 hours is too long. I couldn't afford to let my officers go for that long, that expense, especially if they have to go on an overnight stay. You're going to have to do a heck of a lot of locals if you're not planning an overnight stay. And something to take back to the people that had the program. I sat through this with some chiefs and sheriffs in Mankato, a kind of a scenario of the program, what was going to be taught, and I wasn't that impressed that people that came in there from the organization had kind of a chip on their shoulder and kind of painted all cops with the same brush. And they just assumed that most cops did this, when 99% of the cops that handle these types of situations handle it correctly, whether it's use of force or deadly force. And it just maybe convey to them that when the cop on the street faces somebody with an edged instrument or a gun 10 feet away, he hasn't got time or she to think with this person's paranoid schizophrenic or came from Vietnam or just having a bad day. He's got to think about him and his family and his survival. And so just remember that when the courses are being given, that cops are human too, and some of them will make mistakes, but then we overreact and go completely the other way to 40 hours of training and a lot of expenses. And so just to balance it off.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. Further?
Madam Chair, I just want to say
Mallory.
One thing. John Delmonico, who's the president of the Minneapolis Federation of Police, said that he wanted it known that he extremely supported this program and the grant program, because it's been, he thought it was incredibly effective at defusing a lot of situations in Minneapolis.
Thank you. Representative Mullery renews his motion that House File 449 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Health Care and Human Services Policy and Oversight Committee.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Madam Chair, I don't see that Chairman Tamar is here. I came in late. Is this still ultimately going to be in your bill, or would it be in the health? Okay, great. That was my question.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Simon. The chair moves that House File 212 be laid over for possible inclusion in the public safety omnibus bill. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm sorry I wasn't here right at the beginning of the hearing. There was some confusion as to when I'd be up. It's good to be back. I missed this committee. I'm not on it anymore. Members, this bill is pretty simple, File 212, and it basically provides that a pretrial filing of a written transcript of a law enforcement vehicle is not a prerequisite for admission of that recording into evidence. And I need to make a distinction here, members. It's not that we're saying a court can't require a transcript. A court can require a transcript. But a court, we're saying, can't, and currently isn't able to, require it as a condition of admitting it. In other words, a court can't say, as is the current practice, in order for the jury to see this, there must be a written transcript. Now, let me explain what might seem to be a tension there. This came to my attention through a person with my same name, actually, and I thought we were going to make legislative history here, but Professor Steve Simon, no relation, was going to be here from the University of Minnesota Law School, but he couldn't because of a death in the family at the last minute. So instead, what I have and what's being passed out to you is his letter to me of a little bit over a year ago, which really explains the bill in its entirety and the reason for it. But let me summarize, members. First of all, what he tells me and what would the DWI task force has told me and others of you, I think, is that there are an increasing number of judges, of courts, that are reading into the rules of evidence something that's not there. There's no rule of evidence right now that requires a transcript as a condition of admitting a police audio or videotape. There's no rule of criminal procedure that requires it either. But there's some judges, he didn't name them or name where they sit, that are sort of reading that requirement into the rules. And all this statute would do would be to make clear what the law seems to be right now. We wouldn't need this bill at all were it not for this apparent practice that's going on. So that's all that the bill does. And the reason that's important and the reason why we care, and you're going to hear some testimony in a minute, and the letter points out, is there's a high volume of cases that require transcripts. You know, all state patrol vehicles and many police vehicles have, you know, sort of dashboard cameras, and we're talking about tens of thousands of cases per year, where if every judge were to do this, there would be virtual paralysis in law enforcement of having to produce a transcript each and every time. And keep in mind, as the letter before you from Professor Simon says, you know, it's very tough to know how many, if any, of these cases are going to go to trial. So what ends up happening is, as a precautionary measure, if this trend continues, you're going to have law enforcement, not just the state patrol, but law enforcement everywhere, feeling the need to go to great time and expense to prepare a transcript for a case that might not even go to trial. And there are other reasons why a transcript isn't always necessary or desirable anyway. we've all watched the cop shows, I'm sure, and sometimes what people say on the tape is just plain inaudible. So it would be tough to certify a transcript anyway, and a person making the transcription might not know whether the person said gun or gum, and it might be one of those things that is in fact an issue for the jury to decide. They can watch the tape or listen to the tape themselves and decide. So I want to turn it over to someone with real-world experience in this particular area from the State Patrol. He can introduce himself and tell you kind of in a real-world way what he faces with these issues.
Please go ahead, state your name for the record.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Simon. My name is Mike Oslis, and I'm a major with the State Patrol. I've served for 32 years. I'm an operations major. I have oversight of 9 of our 11 patrol districts, so several hundred troopers in my bailiwick. I think I can keep my testimony and remarks pretty brief, but just a couple of preliminary comments. I served with Professor Simon on the DWI task force, have for years, and wish he was here, but as mentioned, he's at a funeral. But we work together, and we've talked a lot about this. I don't claim to represent the Minnesota Chiefs or Minnesota Sheriffs. I don't want to suggest that, but we have talked. There are the executive director of each of those associations and I have met to go, what do we do about this mutual problem? So we're really in this predicament together. Minnesota arrests about 44,000 impaired drivers a year. State Patrol, somewhere around 6,000, sometimes 7,000 of those. So as Representative Simon says, a lot of arrests. Here's a couple of important points. When we stop an impaired driver, the in-squad video that is in hundreds of our squad cars, thousands of Minnesota squad cars, that video goes on when the lights come on. And we also require, for risk management and evidence and preventing false complaints, we also require our troopers to prepare to keep an audio, a handheld audio of the DWI arrest. So you have at least one in-squad video, one audio tape, and that's if other officers aren't involved in each arrest. And each arrest often goes two and a half hours. And then there's tapes made at testing facilities, and in some cases there's tapes made at jails. So you can have multiple tapes
each hours long for each arrest. When you think about the court reporter, and whether it's the court reporter is in a two or three person Q&A statement, or a formal deposition with multiple people, or a court reporter in the courtroom, one thing is clear: they need one person talking at a time. They can't have multiple people. They need to know who the players are, and sometimes they'll even say, "Your Honor, I can't keep up." And the judge will remind people, one person at a time, so they can accurately transcribe. So I'll just set the stage, and I have brought some sample videos, and I realize you have a full agenda, so I respect you may not want to review those, but I'd be happy to leave them, either with the chair, Representative Simon, and members can look at those at your will, because it illustrates very clearly what I'm going to just kind of highlight. When you have a DWI arrest, if it involves a pursuit, which sometimes it does, one of the examples does, in fact two of them do, you have multiple radios, multiple squad cars, all sorts of people communicating, and you don't have a clue who's saying what. It's just impossible to know. And so the transcript often says inaudible or unknown. You have pages of type without any real benefit or information. Then you have witnesses, you have tow truck drivers, you have paramedics, all unidentified, but they're coming onto the mic that's being worn by the trooper or being picked up by the in-squad video. Then you have the driver and passengers. And let's say that it's one of those many cases where the chemical test, we've got more of them, that are going to an emergency room. Now you have people completely unrelated to the arrest that are being picked up by probably both tapes, the in-squad that's running as well as the handheld. You have patients, you have a doctor or more, you have nurses, and it is a mess. And then you get into the jail, and you have the same multiple thing. So our transcriptionists go, "You have to be kidding me. There's no way we can do that." And justifiably, court reporters are saying, "Your Honor, I don't think we can do that either." And so, just to use a layperson's analogy, it's a little bit like, why would you want to review the script of a movie when you can watch the actual movie? It's there in living color. And it just needs to be played and taken for whatever it is. And if it's not audible, it's not audible. When some people say, well, what does this cost the State Patrol? It doesn't. And that's because we've had to take the unfortunate but real position of saying, prosecutor, with all due respect, we understand that that is the rule, but we can't do it. We just physically cannot do it. We don't have the staff, and there's no way that we'd ever ask for the money to hire the staff to do it. And so we say, if you're going to be required in your court district to submit a transcript along with the recording, we respectfully ask that you don't submit the recording. So then one of two things happens. One, you have a prosecutor that doesn't have the strength of their case that they otherwise would when they negotiate a plea plea agreement. And the second thing is, and probably more importantly, you have some incredibly powerful and good and compelling evidence that a jury probably ought to see. And because of these requirements that Representative Simon and Professor Simon have detailed, it just doesn't make it to the courtroom. And so that's sort of a view from the street and our perspective on this matter. We're certainly grateful that this is being brought to the legislature's attention for what seems like a pretty simple fix.
Thank you. Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Simon, your bill would do nothing to change the requirement that prosecutors provide all their evidence to defense counsel at the time of the first appearance, right? Or as that evidence becomes available, correct?
That's
right. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's correct. That's already a requirement in the state and federal constitution, and they'll always get, both sides always will have a copy of the actual audio or video before. All this says is, and again, the current rules don't have this requirement. The reason for this bill is because there are some judges, I'm told, that are reading into the rules a requirement that doesn't exist. This just clarifies what we all believe to be the current state of affairs, which is there's no requirement for transcripts as a condition of letting the jury see the original. That's all.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, I think you had a great bill. Thanks for bringing it forward.
Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First question is for Major Oslison. I'm sorry, is it still Major?
Yes, sir.
It is, okay. I had you on one of these cases, I don't know how many years ago, I think it was before I was in the legislature, but you and Captain Swanson at the time did a great job, so thank you. What is your current turnaround time for producing these tapes, the squad dash videos, when requested by a prosecutor?
Madam Chair, Representative, they're submitted by the troopers on probably a weekly basis. They tend to accompany the arrest reports to the prosecutor. In some jurisdictions, the prosecutor or attorney general's office, in the case of the implied consent piece of it, tell us, don't bother sending the tape. As soon as we want them, or as soon as defense bar requests a copy, we'll let you know. So they're done within a couple of days of us making the request. And I would say that the majority of the cases are based on request rather than an automatic submission.
Okay, Representative, Madam Chair, and I don't think I've ever received it automatically, unless it was from a non-court date screening where someone was out of custody or tagged out for some reason. I know Kathy Danielson in the East Metro does a fantastic job of trying to keep up with these, but it's still kind of tough, and I get the impression she's very swamped. And that has an impact on how we resolve the cases also. I would also just point out by way of commentary that oftentimes when I have these transcripts done, the court reporters or whoever is taking them down does a better job at hearing what's on there than I do. And oftentimes it's hearing incriminating evidence on there, which maybe I didn't hear. So they come in quite handy to me. But I also understand it is a pain. My next question, if I may, Madam Chair, is for Representative Simon. Representative Simon, based on the bench culture and how judges are reading this into it already when, you know, it's not there, how is this really going to change things? And that when, you know, when the bench decides something's a certain way, they almost decide maybe they'll have to look at the statute or maybe they won't, because it's their courtroom and their God and their courtroom. So how much less of a burden is this actually going to become by spelling it out?
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lesch, I would say at least somewhat less of a burden. You're absolutely right. Judges, you know, sometimes to very often will be creative as to certain rules, let's just put it that way. But and so I can't guarantee that a judge won't just overlook this and say, based on, say, separation of powers, a judge might say, well, you can't dictate our rules of procedure, I'm going to do it anyway. So I understand that limitation. But I think, at least at the margins, and probably more, it will be helpful rather than harmful. But you raise a good point the limitations of this bill.
Representative Johnson, and then Representative Jackson, and then we're going to call for public testimony and wrap this up. Representative Johnson.
Yes,
Representative Jackson.
I have a couple questions for Representative Simon. I imagine that if we've got something codified, wouldn't that assist a prosecutor in perhaps requesting a sidebar and pointing out something that maybe a judge was not aware of? That's one question. And the second is, it strikes me with your example of transcribing when you can't hear dumb versus done, what I like about this is I don't want the transcriber to substitute his or her judgment for the fact finder, who should be, you know, usually the jury.
Right.
Thank you. I don't think that was a question. So I'm going to say, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come to the table, state your name for the record. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I represent a group called the Association of Verbatim Reporters and Captioners, the court reporters, both freelance and official court reporters. I've shared this bill with the court reporters, and they have some significant concerns about the court procedure, how they would, how this actually works in the courtroom and how it would impact their jobs, the cost and delays that would be put upon the court and their process should these transcripts not be prepared prior to trial. I have Jill Garrison, who's a Ramsey County District Court reporter, with me, and I'd like her to talk a little bit about the procedural problems with this legislation, and also just kind of as a general rule, the courts having exclusive province over their procedural rules, which I think we're having a slight, and I'm not here to represent the courts, but I think we're having a slight excursion into their domain. With that, Chair, if you would hear from Jill Garrison, I'd appreciate it.
Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jill Garrison, and I am an official court reporter. I work for a judge here in the 2nd District in Ramsey County. And I'm here. This bill has raised some eyebrows. There is some concern that the when a transcript is prepared ahead of time and brought into court, oftentimes what the judge will require is that it be passed out to the jurors so that everybody in the courtroom, the defense attorney, the prosecutor, the jurors, and the judge, all know what is being said. If it's left to interpretation, you can have everybody in the courtroom think they heard something different. And so that is a concern, because once we get into jury deliberations, more often than not, in a situation where we've had a transcript or a tape of some sort played, and then the jurors follow along with a transcript, they are not allowed to take the transcript itself into the deliberation room, because the tape is the evidence. And they very often, I don't have numbers, but more often than not, one of the questions that we get from jurors is, can we hear that tape again? And so they're brought back in, and the transcript is passed out, and the tape is played again. The concern that I have is, if I have a witness on the stand, and I can't understand what they're saying, they're from the South, or they from another country, or just have an accent, and I can stop them and say, I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you just said. I can ask them to repeat it. I can't do that on a tape. I can't say, oh, stop, I didn't get that. I can't, and then the interpretation is left to me, and I'm the person that's determining what was said, and I don't think that that kind of responsibility should be placed on us. I don't think that we should be doing that. And our judges don't think we should be doing that. That's not really our job. Another problem that we run into is the Court of Appeals and the Minnesota Supreme Court have required transcripts of any audio or digital or video recordings if something is stated in a video. They want transcripts prepared of those. If the case is appealed and they get it in front of them, they know what the jury heard. And they aren't, again, reinterpreting what they're listening to or what I heard as the court reporter. And so that is the concern that I have about the producing of the transcript be done in the courtroom. One other issue that just comes to mind is oftentimes, something that's inadmissible comes out in a tape. And when the transcripts are prepared ahead of time, both the prosecutor and the defense attorney go through and, if they see there's something there that's inadmissible, they'll have that redacted. They'll, advise the judge, and between the three of them, there might be certain portions that are redacted, so that the jury only hears what's admissible, and as opposed to some of the inadmissible things that, people blurt out. So,
thank you. Questions from members? Representative Tamer?
Yes, we hear Representative Simon's response.
Yes, Representative Simon's response.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple quick points, and thank you to Ms. Garrison and Mr. Carlson. By the way, this is a great lesson in the legislative process, because Mr. Carlson and I are close allies and collaborators on a bill that will be heard later this afternoon, and we're on opposite sides this time. So we're all repeat players around here. In terms of following along with the transcript, I think what Representative Jackson said is instructive here, which is, we have to be careful here, especially before it's given to the jury, as opposed to after, about substituting the judgment of a court reporter in every case and saying that there should be some rule for the judgment of the fact finder. The tape is the evidence, not the transcript. That's the important part. And in terms of inadmissible information getting let in, I mean, those are the kinds of issues which will be resolved 9 times out of 10 pre-trial anyway. If one side or the other thinks there's something inadmissible or something that is prejudicial on that tape,
whether it's the defense or the prosecution, they're going to hash that out in a pretrial motion anyway. They're going to stop that, and if they don't, you know, they're going to get in trouble. So those would be my basic responses to that, unless there's any other question or concern.
Further questions from members? Representative Cole.
Well, just to put a finer point on that, Madam Chair, Representative Simon, as I read your bill, there's nothing that would prohibit defense counsel or prosecution, if somebody thought that a transcript would be useful, from coming forward prior to trial and making that point to the judge and playing the tape with 18 people talking and trying to put something trying to make some sense, convince the judge that it makes sense in this particular case. You're just saying with your bill, we're not going to require that as a basis to admit it in the first place, correct?
That's correct. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's correct, Representative Coles. I would just say that, again, the judge can continue after it's admitted to order a transcript. The judge might say, hey, we really want a transcript here. But it can't be a condition of admissibility where the judge says, this jury may not listen to this tape or see this tape unless the state provides a written transcript. And, again, going back to the original idea for the bill is, everyone's understanding was that that is the law right now because there's no evidentiary rule or rule of criminal procedure that requires a transcript. We're just trying to reinforce what everyone believed and thought was the current rule by passing this. And I do think that passing this will send a message to some judges who otherwise might want to skirt the existing rules or read new portions into the rule. It might send a message that they ought not to do that.
Final question, Representative Cornish.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm just going to reiterate that it is a big cost to small cities just with our small department on the transcribing. We haven't got the staff to do it, so we have to have it specially contracted out by someone, and the bill we got was thousands of dollars just for 1 year for a small department if we were forced to do videotapes. It was a lot more complex. It would be a lot more costly. We couldn't afford it.
Thank you. I renew my motion that House File 1212 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Public Safety Policy Omnibus Bill. Thank you, Representative Simon.
Thank you, members.
All right, members, next we have a probation overview, and we actually went over by about 15 minutes, so come on down, and you'll keep in mind that we do usually try to adjourn on time, so there may be portions that you need to do more quickly. And members, while we're waiting for the setup, if someone would make a motion to approve the minutes of February 3rd.
Members.
Who is that? Representative Taft. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Please go ahead, state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ryan Erdman. I'm the director of MACAC, the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties, and I also am the public safety policy analyst for AMC, the Association of Minnesota Counties. And as in that role, I will make very brief introductory comments. I'll draw your attention to the map we distributed here, blue and green and red, just to give you the lay of the land for probation in the state of Minnesota. I'll start with the counties. In blue, those counties' probation services are provided by the Department of Corrections under contract to the counties. The counties in red are what are called county probation or CPO counties. In those counties, a county-based corrections department provides services to juveniles, adult misdemeanors, adult gross misdemeanors, and the State Department of Corrections provides the correctional and probation services to adult felons. And then the third category is community corrections. That's the green counties on your map. And in those counties, all correctional services are provided at the county level. The decision for which type of correction delivery system to use is at the discretion of the county board. But that gives you the very basic lay of the land and how the different counties operate. And today we'll focus on the two county-based systems. Mark Sizer, the Community Corrections Director from Stearns County, will walk you through what a CCA jurisdiction is and what that means. He is the current MACAC president. And then Steve King from Maurer County Corrections, who is the current MACPO president for the CDO counties, will walk you through sort of the nuts and bolts of what that system is all about. So I'll turn it over to them, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Mr. Sizer, please identify yourself.
My name is Mark Sizer. I'm the Community Corrections Division Director for Stearns County and the current MACAC President.
Welcome to the committee, and you may proceed.
Thank you. As I'm sure most of you know, the Community Corrections Act was enacted by the Minnesota State Legislature in 1973. It is a choice of county government to go into the Community Corrections Act Any county that has a population that exceeds 30,000 can go into the act alone. If less than that, they can join up with other contiguous counties and create a Community Corrections Act jurisdiction. Currently, we have 17 jurisdictions in Minnesota, and they include 32 counties because we do have quite a number of counties that have joined together. Example would be Todd and Wadena County, Rock Nobles, as many as five counties in the Arrowhead region. The community corrections counties cover about 75% of the state's population, and they have certain requirements that are unique to the Community Corrections Act. One is that all services in a community corrections jurisdiction for correctional field services be administered under one administration. Another is that they establish a community corrections advisory board, and there are certain members in the community, disciplines, if you will, that are required to serve on that advisory board. Examples would be law enforcement, prosecution, education, etc. The funding for the community corrections counties is also a little different in that there is a CCA subsidy, and that subsidy was created in order to provide funds to counties so that they may create and implement special programs, services, supervision techniques in the local jurisdiction and have less reliance on state institutions. The system is guided by the County Board of Commissioners as opposed to the other two delivery systems, one by the Commissioner of Corrections, Department of Corrections, and in Steve's situation, the Judicial Branch and County Probation Offices. The Community Corrections Act jurisdictions are also required to submit a comprehensive plan on an every 2 year basis. On the off years, they submit an interim plan as well as an interim report. I just did bring two copies of Stearns County's comprehensive plan that I'll leave here for Madam Chair or any member of the committee that would like to review that. There are really three core elements when you look at a community corrections jurisdiction that I'd like to just briefly talk about. One is the one administrative structure, and it is really set up to eliminate duplication of services and work in a collaborative and a participatory planning fashion in a community-based delivery model. The Community Corrections Act funds have in many jurisdictions allowed us to create programs and services that have been very successful in reducing recidivism, assisting offenders, victims, and the community, as well as been model programs not only in Minnesota but across the state. Just a couple examples: juvenile extended day treatment, cognitive life skills programming, diversity planning, gender-specific programming, and probation service centers. The primary goal of the community corrections jurisdictions is to work with offenders in their communities. And I think we can say in Minnesota we've been very successful as we continuously rate 49th currently in the country in our imprisonment rating for sending our offenders to state institutions. We do have a large population under field supervision in Minnesota, and I think our three delivery systems are handling that population very well. The second issue in a Community Corrections Act jurisdiction is governance. And as I mentioned, it is under the County Board of Commissioners. They participate in long-term planning for corrections through this comprehensive planning process. When we create a comprehensive plan in many jurisdictions, that takes the jurisdiction from about April or May through December in any given year to formulate the plan and get it through all the approval processes. The local county board or executive committee in a multiple county jurisdiction is the decision-making body, and they control all the programming and all the services. And what is a nice thing about that is that what works in Hennepin County may not necessarily be appropriate for Roseville County or Goodhue County. We also have citizen participation. Advisory boards are required to have citizens on their advisory committees. Stearns County has 5 citizens representing each of the county board jurisdictions, and they are invaluable in bringing their opinions, ideas, and questions to the process. And the third and final main consideration is funding. And this used to be, I can say, having 33 years in the system, perhaps a larger issue than it is today, but the CCA formula is run for all 87 counties, and when a jurisdiction is considering coming into the Act, they look at, will it increase funding? Will the subsidy enhance their funding streams? Will it be less money? So when we talk to jurisdictions, it's often the money that's discussed first before the philosophy or the approach of those three delivery systems. I'm going to stop there and give Mr. King the floor, Madam Chair, unless there are questions.
I actually do have a couple of questions here. Let me start, members, by just saying that the Department of Corrections has enlightened me that I only invited 2 of the 3 providers, and that the Department of Corrections also provides probation, and that I was negligent in inviting them, even though that they have been before us 3 times since we started. I should have had them back a 4th time, I guess. So one of the questions that I get asked a lot is, why do we have 3 systems and should there be 1? So I'm going to ask you that, and I'm going to ask the other testifier as well. So can you enlighten me as to what you think about that?
I'm going to have to be very careful on whether or not I give my personal opinion or a MACAC position on that. The Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act counties has talked about that, I believe, as has MACPO and the Department of Corrections many times. Before 1973, we had obviously the 2 delivery systems. The Department of Corrections supervised all adult felony and adult gross misdemeanor offenders in Minnesota. County probation departments supervised all juvenile and adult misdemeanors. There may have been, and I don't know this for sure, certain counties that at that time did contract all services with the Department of Corrections. In 73, the Community Corrections Act came into being, and there were 3 pilot jurisdictions, and then over the years, more and more counties joined the Act. Until today, we have 32. So part of my answer is the reason we have 3 delivery systems in Minnesota is simply that's how it has evolved. When we talk about should we have 1 delivery system, that's where we start getting into debates, arguments, and differing opinions. I think we can say quite confidently, when we look at our rate of commitment to state institutions, Minnesota has one of the best field services operations when it comes to corrections in the entire country. I mean, just taking, for example, the state of Wisconsin and comparing them to Minnesota, the demographics are very, very equal. The population is equal. They have nearly 3 times the people in their state institutions and half the people we have on field supervision. So we have a very, very good system that works very well, even though there are 3 delivery systems.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I've worked in probation for 30-plus years, and I'm familiar with some of the things going on in that respect. The question I have is looking at as caseloads rise and probably continue to rise, and as resources dwindle, I'm curious what would you propose, or what are some of the ideas you have to deal with that issue, and what kind of policies would you put forth that could either lessen caseloads or make it more effective to provide the kind of prevention services in the community that are needed.
Mr. Sipes.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative, that's an excellent question. We have seen caseloads rise over the years, and what many jurisdictions have done is they have started to triage these caseloads. and many use a research-based validated risk needs assessment tool. And I'll give an example. The level of service inventory revised comes from James Bonta, Dr. Bonta, out of Ottawa, Ontario. It's very widely used, and what we do is we classify offenders as high, medium, and low risk. Then we go to evidence-based practices and we look at the research. And the research will show you that if you impose intensive supervision, treatment, and intervention programs on low-risk offenders, you can actually increase their recidivism rate rather than reduce it. So we take those low-risk offenders and we start moving them off to probation reporting centers, administrative caseloads, where simply their sanctions and controls are monitored. Then we put the high and medium risk offenders on a traditional caseload, and we provide the appropriate level of supervision, a higher level of supervision to those individuals. Then we begin to specialize. For example, we will have an intensive supervision program for repeat DWI offenders. We'll have sex offender supervision, specialization, domestic violence, mental health, female, gender-specific, and we start to look at the specific issues surrounding those populations.
Madam Chair?
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
I'm aware of those management techniques, and I think those are very good professional ways to go. But I'm more interested in what new ideas do you have or do you think the legislature should consider at this time, given the fact we're in this huge budget deficit, and we're going to see our caseloads likely increase, and again, resources dwindle. Do you have any ideas as to policy changes that we could provide, not just that you could do internally, but that the legislature could offer that might make for better probation supervision?
Mr. Sizer or Mr. King, if either one of you have some thoughts on that?
If I could, Madam Chair.
Mr. King.
From my standpoint, supervising gross misdemeanors and misdemeanors, I think the legislature is doing a nice job in making certain driving offenses payable, not allowing them to go through the court system, not allowing them to be placed on probation, yet just pay the court administration the fine and be down the road. I think that certainly helps my business, specifically with dealing with gross misdemeanors and misdemeanors.
All right. Questions from members? Representative Drakowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the question I have is a follow-up on Representative Johnson. Are there any particular redundancies that you see that are inherent in the existence of the three systems?
Who would like
to? You know,
Mr. King.
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative. I've had the luxury of working in all three over my 21 years in corrections, all three delivery systems, and from a pure probation officer standpoint, There's very little difference between supervision in a Community Corrections Act county, county probation county, or a DOC county. Pre-sentence investigations get written by, reports get completed to the judge, and supervision gets taken care of. The redundancies, I don't see any. I just don't. I think we got three delivery systems, yes, but they're not competing against each other. They're not conflicting with each other. I think we all do a real decent job in Minnesota. Handling community services side of corrections. Your question earlier too, Madam Chair, if I could, about the DOC, should we have one delivery system, whatever that delivery system should be. My concern with that would be the Department of Corrections emphasizes a good share of their budget and resources on institutions. They certainly address probation in the 28 counties that they have, as well as parole services. But I would be concerned that community services would suffer under one system. From my standpoint, down in rural Minnesota, Austin, Minnesota, Moore County, we're a population of about 34,000 people in the county. We're not really near any major metropolitan area. We know our people, and that's the benefit of county probation is we certainly have the risk assessment tools that everybody else uses. We use evidence-based practices. We report to the Department of Corrections for their grants and their reimbursements that they allow us. But it's the people of that county are typically not very nomadic. They're there. We have third generation offenders. That doesn't tell you we're doing a very good job down there, but that's just the reality. So when a family walks in the door, we automatically know what services they need from history. So that's a community or a CPO.
Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I certainly tend to agree with the testifiers that, you know, what's right for Hennepin County may not be what's right for Roseau County, and so I don't have an inherent problem with the three systems. I guess I'm just looking at, or my question follows up, though, on your point, Madam Chair, and that is, are there any differences from the bench's perspective, from the judge's perspective? I look at the First Judicial District, and it has all three of the systems, and I see that some of the other judicial districts do as well. And so if I'm a judge in the First Judicial District, which is where I am, and I happen to be in Carver County one day, and somebody's sick, and so I'm over in Dakota County the next day, and then I end up in McLeod County, I'm in three different systems, three different days, maybe in the same week. Are there any differences from the judge's perspective in terms of the system?
Mr. King.
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, I think that speaks to what I said. There's really, as far as day-to-day probation office work, there's very little difference. I think the bench sees it that way, too. Court rules are followed, statutes are followed, and it's just a matter of who's going to do the supervision. The judges clearly know that in CPO County, a community, MACPO County, if you will, the felony levels will go to the Department of Corrections, and anything less than that will go to my office. Where with the difference maybe is with a MAC Act county, is they handle it all. But I don't think if you're a judge in one county that has three delivery systems, that you're at all confused.
Mr. Feiger.
Madam Chair, just to follow up on that, it's very true, judges may move from one jurisdiction to another, but judges may also move from one county to another, and a certain county may have a more robust tax base, therefore they have more resources. They may have a larger population, therefore they have three or four mental health centers versus one. So I think you could almost overlay many different issues, and the judges learn to work with those differences.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And probably more a comment than a question, and that is, you know, just, again, having worked in the business for such a long time, I just want to point out, and you folks probably want to are aware of this as much as anybody, but the extent to which responsibilities for probation have increased so tremendously over the last 30 years, where in the past, the supervision meeting with a client was more informal and directed in a certain goal to get a job or go to school, that sort of thing. Now probation officers, in addition to rising caseloads, and this gets against the management, how are we going to deal with the number of increased caseloads with less staff, with more responsibilities, is where I'm trying to get to. But at this point, a probation officer, unlike 10 years ago, now he has to do DNA testing, registration of sex offenders, domestic abuse assessments, investigations, working in community crimes, impact calendar, cognitive skills groups. There's a variety of responsibilities that we have today that we didn't have 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 5 years ago, that we have today that we want to continue because it is the right thing to do, and I think it does help supervise, it's good for the community and prevents recidivism. But we have to keep in mind there's only so many hours in a day. And like I said, the numbers are increasing, the resources are going down, and I think we might seriously have to look at what some of the policy changes we need to do at the state level to make it more palatable to provide the services that we're expected to do.
All right, Mr. Sykes.
Madam Chair, Representative, I could just comment on that. We have tracked that. In 1980, probation officers had 17 core responsibilities. Today, they have 73. And they're the very things that were mentioned by the representative. Many of our probation officers today have master's degrees. They're very well trained. They're professionals, and they take on these mandates and these services and tasks very, very well. But I do have to tell you, I started as a probation officer in December of 1976, and it was a very, very much simpler world back then. Cases were much simpler. The level of sophistication of our caseloads, the dangerousness of our caseloads, and the number of duties and responsibilities we had were far less. I don't know if I'd want to be a probation officer today with the workload burden that they currently have.
I actually have three questions. We're kind of running out of time, but one, what do your each system use for outcome measures? So if you don't have them today, if you could provide those to the committee so that we have something to see how great of a job you're doing. And then we've also been hearing a lot about revocation and the definition of a technical revocation versus someone committing a new crime. So if we could get a sense of what is happening in each of your systems, whether you're seeing more revocations based on technical violations or new crimes, and then whether or not you think there should be a revocation center. We're starting to hear that emerging across the country. So those are three, you know, big issues. I'm certain you can't answer them in 4 minutes, but if you'd like to give it a shot, we'd like to hear your thoughts. Mr. Sizer.
Madam Chair, as I had mentioned, CCA jurisdictions are required to do a comprehensive plan, and there are four key outcome measures that we are required to report on. One is community safety, and we look at, of course, recidivism rates. A second one is restoration of crime victims. So we do look at restitution, community service work, restoring our crime victims. Three is community restoration. So we look at things such as sentence to service, again, community service work, things that we do to restore our communities. And then finally, offenders are developing competencies. So that gets us back into the assessment tools. Are they coming in without a job, leaving with a job, no education, have a GED when they leave, those types of things. So those are four core outcomes that we do track.
Mr. King, did you have anything to add to that?
You know, our outcome measures are much different than a CCA county. We certainly, we measure restitution dollars, community service work hours, chemical dependency assessments, and we track our juvenile justice screens anytime a juvenile comes into our office. Our reports are required to the state for our subsidy that they provide, or they reimbursement, I'm sorry. So we do an annual probation officer reimbursement salary scale to them, and we also do quarterly reports for the grants that we receive from them. But as far as outcome measures, we don't have we talked about this over lunch. If I had to produce an outcome measure report like that, I'd have to hire staff. And so it's just we do a much smaller version to the judges and to the county board.
All right, so what about technical violations versus new crimes and revocation centers?
Technical violations, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, thank you. Technical violations, by the time, technical violations aren't necessarily petty, aren't necessarily should be overlooked. In a typical probation officer's world, the technical violations are going to add up to about 3, 4, 5 before we take them back in front of the judge, or perhaps in front of the hearings and relief officer to put that person or ask that person to be reincarcerated. Technical violations are something that we deal with every day. It's just that we handle them in-house until it gets to a certain level where we've either had enough and they keep violating, and we need to do something, step it up a little bit. That's when they either go back in front of the judge for another probation sanction, or in the case of handling felony supervision, they go back in front of the Department of Corrections hearing officer for readmittance back into the prison.
Revocation centers? Mr. Sizer.
I'm not sure what a revocation center is. I'm just going to have to ask if you could clarify.
Mr. Carter, do you have any insights?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think some states are doing revocation centers where instead of going to prison, they would go to a center in the local community for 1, 2 to 3 months for a wake-up call. Some of the centers have some treatment facilities, treatment involved, and they say they're much less expensive than a prison bed.
Mr. King?
Madam Chair, in the world that I work in, we just handle gross misdemeanors and misdemeanors, so none of our offenders are eligible to go back into the prison system. And let me also speak to that. In our population, we will fill up a jail. You know, that's equal to the prison. It's still, it's costly, and it's something we have to keep in mind. We have to balance that because we don't want to fill up the violations that they have new arrestees they're bringing in. But in the world I work in, it would be a jail cell, not a prison cell.
Well, thank you very much for your comments today. I apologize you didn't get the opportunity to even finish your report. If you have anything else that you think this committee should know, as we make decisions going forward, please feel free to submit those in writing, and I'm certain there will be proposals and you'll have the opportunity to do that. With that, members, this meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.